We have a donut called a dirt donut.
Come on.
We do. It's got a gummy worm on it. It's so cool. I didn't think to bring it. I should have.
Next time.
That's a total loss, really. I had a chance to
have a dirt donut. You didn't bring a dirt donut for dirt. The one guy who's down the pipe on your brand.
Podcast is over.
Welcome to Aggressive Life. Man, you never know what you're going to get into. Some days, dirt. I love my day at work.
This is a fun one today.
Some days I come to work and go, oh, today's going to be fun.
It's that day.
It is that day. So, because this is one of the things I was looking forward to today. We have a guest live in the studio, and he's a long time friend. I mean long. I'm talking over 40 years. This is a guy who's been doing aggressive things for a long, long time. He's been a serial entrepreneur, and that got him in a lot of trouble, or at least people didn't understand him early on. We'll talk about that. But his most recent entrepreneurial endeavor started in 2009. Peace, Love, and Little Donuts opened up its first shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, adopting a 60s theme, has a deadhead character on it with Peace, Love, and Little Donuts. It's really, really great. These itty-bitty cute donuts, he wanted to create a fun, nostalgic experience around fresh, made-to-order donuts. I just had one just before we started. Let's talk about him. Let's talk about his move. Let's talk about our friendship. His name is Ron Rossetti, also known as Ronnie. Welcome to the Aggressive Life, Ron Rossetti.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it, man. It's good to be here. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, man.
My old hometown, your new hometown.
That is a weird thing.
We traded lives, which is sort of funny.
I hadn't thought about that before. That's really, really true. So Ronnie and I met in Pittsburgh. I was born and bred in Pittsburgh. Ronnie moved from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh to be in the same student ministry training program that I was in. And then I obviously ended up leaving Pittsburgh to come to Cincinnati, so we kind of flip-flopped. What do you think about the two cities? How similar or dissimilar do you think that they are right now?
Well, being river towns, there's some similarities, but most of it is, I think, tied to the fact that they're sitting on the same river, right?
Right.
So I think Pittsburgh is way more blue-collar, way less in sort of tech, I would say, than Cincinnati.
Pittsburgh P&G. Is less in tech than Cincinnati.
Less tech, yeah.
Oh, I thought it would have been more right now.
Nah. I mean, they tried to do their tech bubble, but it was kind of a bridge too far.
I was driving as a little kid down from the eastern suburbs of Pittsburgh into Pittsburgh. As a little kid, every time I go visit my family on the other side of town, every time I would go to Three River Stadium to see a Steelers game. Actually, no, I never saw a Steelers game because you have to inherit those tickets. Anytime I would go to a Pirates game, anytime I'd go to a Penguins game, I would drive down my parents' station wagon, their back seat, all down the river, plant after plant after plant after plant. Were you in Pittsburgh when those plants were still up?
No.
Were they abandoned when you came to Pittsburgh? Were they being torn down when you came to Pittsburgh?
I think just being torn down. I mean, Pittsburgh was undergoing its sort of conversion from steel to something else. And something else hadn't really emerged yet. But I got there in 83.
Well, I thought it was all tech medical stuff that all took that space right along the river, no?
Some of it, yeah. The turn at J&L, yeah. That's what's still there, I think. But it's not enough tech to have saved the city from, you know, a shift, major shift. But there's more medical now, I think.
Medical, that's
all
right.
All related to the hospital systems, which are vibrant, yeah, and the colleges.
So give us a little bit of your story. Before we dig into Peace, Love, and Little Donuts, I'm probably going to have another one right now. Do we have another one that has nuts on it?
Yeah.
Which one has nuts on it?
This one here.
This is nuts right here?
Yeah, yeah.
What is that one called?
I think that's the Don't Fear the Reese's.
And how much drugs do you have before you name these things, by the way?
I can neither confirm or deny the involvement of any substances.
I don't know if I'm going to eat a whole one
in
here,
the creation.
I'm going to give it a little.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well. dirt? Are you eating any of these?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get one for three.
Are you protecting your figure or something like that?
I got to wash my hands first.
Dude, if anybody needs to be just powering down calories, it's you. Look at you. Dude, come on.
It's part of his employment agreement.
Right.
Exactly. He must consume at least four of these a day.
He should. So yeah, anyway.
I started this out not really imagining in 2009 that this was going to turn into what it turned into. So, you know, people think, wow, this is a genius idea. But it didn't ever sort of show up as a genius idea. It came in as a spaghetti up against the wall version of business. Just we were in dire straits financially from another business that I had that I started that failed horribly. And it was just taking a nosedive. And
what business was that that failed?
The popcorn factory.
Oh, that's right.
So we were producing a popped popcorn in a bag that had Marcy's image on it. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's sort of cool. But and we had 1,000 grocery stores. And then in a matter of months, we went from 1,000 to zero.
Why? How?
Well, we outsourced our manufacturing to another company. That company turned out to be unscrupulous, and then they refused our purchase orders and then took all of our contracts. So we ended up losing, you know, all those accounts. So it was free fall, really. Mars took a job working for Robert Morris University, which ensured, because her job had tuition benefits, it ensured that the kids all could go to college for Bupkis.
Mm. Great.
Really, miracle. And then I agreed to take a job and actually accepted a position at a financial services firm that I was like, okay, I'll do this if this is a way to keep the lights on. And in the process, we thought, let's start this little goofy idea I have in the back of my mind to do this donut thing. And if it pays our electric bill at the end of the month, great. But it's probably never going to do much more than that. And it didn't really take off. Not in that sense. But you and I were in the ministry training together years and years ago, 83, 84, 85. And then you took a job. We were actually on staff at the same church, not at the same time.
Right. I succeeded you.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they upgraded. We'll just put it that way. But when I was there, the senior pastor left. And when he left, everybody left. And you ended up with an associate who came back and got called as the senior.
Right.
And so you worked for him, and I was already gone.
Mm-hmm. Right. Correct. So you going way, way back, though, to when you were in ministry, you were always in your mind thinking about some business thing, something. Like, I remember you having a little clay model when we were in college. You were carving out a clay model that would be a new driver for the end of a screwdriver that wouldn't slip.
Yeah.
I remember you talking about a contraption that would suck the air out of the gas tank while you simultaneously pumped in the gas so you could have your car, you know, filled more quickly. I remember, what other ones?
I had the windshield wiper that would adjust to the volume of rain.
You did have that one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd been to the patent office, I don't know how many times. I mean, I grew up in an environment that was entrepreneurial, so this kind of stuff just got on me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's kind of what you grew up with. My dad was an entrepreneur. He actually has patents at the patent office. He and his brother became, I guess you would call them, light industrialists. They had a manufacturing facility here in Cincinnati, and for years were big employers here. Mm. And I grew up, cut my teeth really in all aspects of that business. So I didn't do anything important. Cut the grass. Refiled things, fixed this, go fill an order, go pull parts, whatever needed to happen. I was 14, 15, 16, 17. Yep.
So you had a number of those things that didn't come to fruition or failed, as in
never tried,
the popcorn.
Yeah. Right.
And then something worked. What was the difference between what worked as opposed to the ones that didn't work?
It's hard to necessarily deconstruct the failures as much as you can. It's hard to figure out successes sometimes. You think, oh, this cake tastes really good. What's the ingredient that's the most important? I don't know. But if you took one of them out, it probably wouldn't taste as good. So the same way I look backwards at all the challenges and the things that I did wrong and I thought, that was probably a bad move, led to this opportunity. And when this thing sort of ran me over, I mean, this thing was never my brainchild. I mean, I did.
Ran you over. I like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nobody, Our whole first month's revenue of Peace, Love, and Little Donuts was $4,000, and we do $4,000 a day now. So it's not, I mean, it wasn't a runaway success. Nobody thought it was going to work, not even me. This was absolute financial desperation, and that's the way it was. And then sure enough, you know, God rescued us from what the direction we were in, and we turned around and ended up, you know, really hopefully riding this into retirement or a legacy business that our kids will one day inherit.
So give the story how you discovered you could make a little donut and how you built on it, because it was one decision after another, one thing you would notice after another. Sometimes we think our life, if we're going to make the big decision, we've got to have this big planning session, and we've got to dream big, and we've got to plan big, we've got to spend big. But often it's just noticing something and going, I'm going to take a step there, and then noticing something else, and I'm going to take a step there. That's kind of the business story for Peace, Love, and Little Donuts, right?
That is. And I think part of the thing is when you have a failure or a success, it ends up changing your instincts. You have a different set of instincts, which is perspective, right? I mean, instincts is the part of your perspective that becomes congealed into action. So when you decide something makes sense, something is clear to you. It's clear because of what you've come to understand by the way you've experienced the world so far. And so for that, I'm grateful for the mistakes, because I think they did make me see things differently. And because of that, I saw this thing start to move. And I thought, there's people standing in the rain to get donuts. I'd go home to Marcy and I'd say, I do not know what's going on here. Mm. I have the foggiest idea why people are staying in the rain. What I didn't understand is at the time, Dunkin' had decided to go to a model where they make donuts offsite, they bring them in frozen and thaw them out. So fresh disappeared. Oh. So most people who are younger than us have never had the donut you're eating right now, never had a donut that was made minutes ago, not just, you know, today. Most donuts are made days ago, if not longer than that, because they go through a freeze cycle, and then when they get thawed out, whenever they need to be sort of breathed life back into.
When did Dunkin' Donuts make that decision?
When Bain Capital took them private and reorganized
Mitt
them.
Mitt Romney, you rat bastard. You dirty Mormon. Look what you've done. Look what you've done to an American pastime.
Hey, I probably
he's
should
not
send
a dirty Mormon. That kind of dirty Mormon. He's not a dirty Mormon.
No, but I should send him a thank you.
Nothing dirty in Mitt Romney at all.
I should send
he's
him a thank you
He's a good man
note.
Who's clean and has nothing in common with dirt
and
at all.
And has no dog strapped to the roof of his car. None. So anyway, I think.
That is Mitt Romney's, right? Bain Capital is Mitt Romney.
Yeah, it is. Good memory. Peace, Love, and Little Donuts started to go. And the first indication that people were—
Before you say first indication, like, take us how did it start? How did you discover to make a small donut?
Well,
So
I was in another business where I was selling motorcycle insurance. And I went to the other side of Columbus, Ohio, to a place called Marysville, Ohio, which used to have a plant that made Honda motorcycles. They don't make them there anymore, but that's where they made the Honda motorcycle for a while, other than Southern California. So they have this event there called Honda Homecoming, where they invite Honda owners from all over the country, wherever you come here, get to ride the new Hondas. You get to go in the parking lot. The parking lot's full of vendors, people trying to sell you more stuff for your Honda or whatever bike you're on. And it's pretty exciting if you're a motorcyclist. I ride, you ride. We've both ridden for years, and I was selling motorcycle insurance, so I came there to give out business cards and do quotes for motorcycle insurance. Well, because they don't want to turn everybody loose for lunch, they have food vendors set up in the parking lot. One section of the parking lot was set up with food, and there was a lady there making mini donuts off of a table, folding table under a 10 by 10 pop-up tent. She had a frittin' line for 3 days. Mm. And at the time, my wife is a flight attendant, and she's starting to say, I don't want to be a flight attendant anymore. Then that plane in Pittsburgh crashes and kills everybody, U.S. Airways. And that kind of put the nail in the coffin for her. She was like, I don't know how long I am for the door. I think I'm done with being a flight attendant. But she didn't really have any vision for what she might do. And I thought, here's this lady, rolls this out of the trunk of her car. She's printing money. Like, it's perfect for a mom who wants to be mostly a mom and wants to do something else. So I called Marcy. I go, I've seen your future. You're going to be the donut lady. And she goes, no, there's no way, no way. And then another thing happened at US Airways, and they offered an early out. And she came back and said, okay, let's talk about this donut idea you saw. So that was the beginning of it. We bought a machine used on the internet. We put it together on my living room floor. We started making really tiny donuts that would fit almost in your water bottle. Mm. Minis, the kind you get in a six-pack at the convenience store. And that worked on weekends for a while. And then we ended up in the popcorn business for a long time, and we quit making donuts because we were making so much money on popcorn. So we just stopped doing it. But I still had the machine. And I finally sold the machine. Quit even thinking about ever doing donuts again. And some guy who owns a bunch of equipment calls me, and he's buying raw popcorn from me. I buy truckloads of it, like semis full of raw popcorn because of my popcorn company. He wants to buy just a couple bags. So he says, hey, can I buy a couple bags? I say, come in. And next thing I know, he calls me and says, I got a bunch of concession equipment. And I think I need to get rid of it. I'd stored in a lady's garage. I got to get it out of the garage. She's not going to let me rent the garage anymore. So it was just a crime of convenience. He needed somebody to buy this crap that he had. And he said, I think this is stuff you might be interested in. So I got to take a look at it. There's only one thing. It's this donut maker. He goes, you want it? I go, not really. And he says, I'll make you a heck of a deal. I'm like, oh, I still don't really want it. And it was even broken. It didn't work. I go, come on, man. I mean, I don't want it, and I don't think it's good to sell. He says, okay, I'll tell you what, give me $800, it's yours. And it's probably, I don't know, $4,000 machine. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I can't get hurt, so I'll just have it as a backup. Well, I load it in the truck, and he tells me, I said, okay, I'll see you. He goes, oh, no, you got to come get the rest of it. I go, what do you mean the rest of it? There's no rest of it. I've used this equipment. I know what it does. He goes, oh, no, there's a big freaking thing you got to come get. It's in the garage, and that's the thing I need out of my way because I can't store it here anymore. I go, I'm telling you, there's nothing else. Well, he opens the garage door, and there is a 6-foot-long, 2-foot-wide, 3-foot-tall fire suppression cabinet that's designed for the machine that I just bought to sit on top of and to legally convert an indoor space into a donut shop.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so I didn't know that. I didn't know what to do with it, but I loaded it in the truck because he said, you got to take it. I didn't pay anything extra for it. So I get it home and I don't know how to use it. And it's in the garage for months. And then Marcy says, what are you going to do with that? I go, I don't know. She goes, either use it or get it out of here. I'm like, okay. Then she finally says, there's something going on at the hockey complex and there's going to be 1,000 hungry hockey players. Ask my boss if you can set up and make donuts. I'm okay. So I ask him, kind of one of those, you don't want to let me make donuts, do you, for the tournament? He goes, I'd have to charge you something. I go, okay. And that was a Monday night. Wednesday, we set up and we started a 4-day tournament, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And we did like 800, 900, 1,000, 1,100 bucks day after day after day. And we were able to legally set up and make donuts inside. Normally, you could never do that without a fire suppression hood. This was kind of like a Gen Air. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
Where it sucks the air in.
Yes, yes.
That's what this was. And it had its own fire suppression system, and it was all, you know, fully legit. Huh. And so after that, I thought, I'd like to do more of this. I think it rained while I was there, and I'm inside. Mm. In the past, I'd be running for cover. Hot oil and rain are not friends.
Right.
And the last thing you want to do, it's like being under fire, like incoming, right? You got to run. So anyway, that would began the process.
And it was that donut machine was the size of these little donuts?
No, we were doing the minis. We didn't start making
You wouldn't
this.
Call these minis? What would
no,
you call these?
No, these are little.
Okay.
Believe it or not, when I opened the first donut shop in the Strip, we had both.
Okay.
I bought the equipment to make a regular donut in the Strip District.
Club.
No. I've tried to sell them donuts. I keep trying to sell them. I keep trying to sell the Strip Club's donuts.
I got a place that I could store my donuts.
I stand in that Strip Club parking lot all the time, and I can't get them to buy a donut. So the strange thing is that the the whole process started off in this little tiny spot. I was going to buy more supplies at this place. I'm driving by this tiny sign that says for rent. And I had just paid for the arts festival in Pittsburgh. You know the arts festival?
Yes.
It's the first week of May or June, and it rains every frittin' time it's raining, right? And so you pay a huge amount of money to set up and do food. And you don't get to do what you want. You get to do whatever they let you do, like whatever no one in their right mind wants to do. 2009 was the year of the swine flu. You know what they let me sell?
Birds.
Pork sandwiches. People thought I was trying to murder them. They're like, is that like infected with the swine flu? Or I'm like, oh, gosh. So we were selling donuts there. We were selling pork sandwiches. We were selling kettle corn. We were doing as much of the miners as we could do to try and make money. And the for whatever reason, people love the donuts. And they asked me, like, where's your donut shop? I'm like, you're standing in it. Like, this is a pop-up, which they didn't call it that back then. But you paid. But the ante, the amount of money you had to put up for 10 days, $11,000.
Wow.
So you're rolling the dice, man. You could get bad weather for 11 days and be out that whole thing. So after that was over, I'm driving for supplies, and we're getting ready to set up for the regatta, which is another outdoor event. And I see this little sign, and I'm thinking, I bet the frittin' whole year's rent's not $11,000 for that spot. And so I just call, because I'm still stinging from paying the rent for 10 days being $11,000. And fortunately, we made a little bit of money, but not nearly as what we needed to make. So turns out this little spot ends up available. I talk to Marcy. I go, you think this will work? She goes, I don't think so. I don't know. Might, but I don't feel like it's a winner. I go, me either. But we should probably do something, because we were headed right down the toilet. And so we opened up in August of 2009, me and Gabriel in the store together. Yeah, the youngest. Yep.
Who also had a cheap clothing store that he's done called Gabriel's, or Gabe's, right?
I wish. I'd be working for him if that was the case. Yeah. I'd be holding the door open. He was there with me, and we did our first day together, August 2009. And it took a long time before we were head above water, about a year and a half. And then we were cash flow positive a little.
And you're in how many stores right now? How many states, cities, whatever?
We have 30 locations either under construction or open right now. We have 5 that are under construction.
And what was the
11 states.
11 states. What was the time when you said, oh, this is going to work, I'm going to make money? Or are you still not saying that?
No. I mean, we're making money. I think right around 2013, 14. So in order to open, I ran out of money before we even opened. I signed the lease like a nut, and I was told I didn't need some expensive plumbing stuff that I was told I didn't need. And then I come to find out, oh, yeah, the health department says you do need that, and you need $5,000. I need to pay a plumber to do it. I ain't got it. So I go home and tell Marcy we're done. I'm just going to give them the keys and tell them to sue me if you want to, but I don't have the money. So if I did, I'd open. I don't have it. And Marcy says, sell my car. I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. She's like, well, you won't know if you don't do it. So I sold a car that I had just bought for her and paid cash for back when the popcorn business was doing well. And then all of a sudden we're broke and got to sell her a car in order to get this place open. So little baby miracles all along the way. I mean, if I listed them all, we'd be here all day. But they are legitimate things that go, that's not possible without God's grace. And so you go, okay, well, I guess we're headed in this direction. So we open up, and then 2013, 2014, I say to Marcy, I'm going to replace, one of these days, I'm going to replace that car you sold. She goes, okay, I hear you talking. You can take me, go get a car anytime you want.
Blah,
I go,
blah, blah,
okay,
blah, blah.
Right. 2016, April, we're laying on a Saturday morning, getting up late, and I said, today's the day. She goes, what's today? I go, we're going to go shopping for a new car. She goes, what's my budget? I go, you don't have a budget. If you want a Silver Cloud Rolls Royce, I'm going to go pay cash for it, and you're going to drive it every day, so choose wisely. And she wanted a vet, and I kept trying to talk her out of it because, you know, Pittsburgh, you can't drive a vet for 12 months.
Right, yeah.
You'd want to drive it, and then you'd wreck it, and then you'd be mad, and then I'd be mad, and then—
No suspension, hitting the potholes.
Terrible.
Horrible.
Night. Right, so I said, but she's such a speed demon, this girl. Lord. Anyway, so she wants to go fast. I get her in front of a Tesla Model S, which I had never heard of.
Yeah.
But it looked fast. The guy said it's fast, and he said it's all-wheel drive. I go, touchdown. So we go test drive it. She about bangs my skull off the headrest in the test drive. And I go, give a guy a heads up before you stomp on that accelerator. And we come back. I said, what do you think? She said, I like it. I don't love it.
And this is back, like Tesla seem like,
this is 2016.
Like blah, blah, blah right now. Yeah, Tesla, whatever. I don't like Tesla, Elon Musk, some
back
people.
Then,
I don't like
it was,
oh, it was the wonder car. It was the Batmobile without gas.
Right. It was a spaceship. And I think the thing was, is she didn't love the S. When we came back to the parking lot where we were doing the test drive, there was a Model X, which is the one with the Falcon wing doors, is sitting there and the doors are open. She goes, what's that? I go, oh, Lord. No. And so the sales guy's with me, and all she does is sit down in the passenger seat and look up at this glass that starts in front of you and runs all the way over your head, one giant sheet of glass. And I said to him, I go, what's the chance this is cheaper than the one we just drove? He goes, none. I go, perfect. So I signaled to Marcy, I go, like, what do you think? And she goes,
she says, yes.
This is the one. So I said to the guy, I go, okay, how do you do this? I mean, how does this work? He goes, well, you go in and you pick your colors and you pick your trim and you pick your thing and you put in an order in, and then maybe 8 months, 9 months, 10 months from now, it'll show up. I go, oh, no, dude, that's not going to work for me. Don't you know I am the most impatient person in the world?
Right.
I said, so we left
there. I'm going to run out of money in 8 or 9 months.
I said, okay. So I got on the internet. I found a cat who had put in a reservation a year and a half before. His number came up, and he didn't have the cash to make it work, but he was willing to sell his place in line. So turns out that vehicle was probably 95% of what we would have ordered if we got to pick everything.
Perfect.
So I jumped the line. I took his spot. It's got everything switched over, and that vehicle was delivered in our driveway on our anniversary, May 26, 2016.
I remember the night that I first saw you guys. I was in Pittsburgh, and it was a rainy night, and you had that, she was driving that. It was like a proud moment for you all. Like, yeah, I blessed my wife here. We're enjoying the fruit of our labors. It was a big deal.
It is. It's always a balancing act. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter whose opinion. I don't care about what anybody else thinks. Mm-hmm. I do care about what Jesus thinks. And so that's the thing. The problem is he isn't giving a post-it note about any of this. Mm-hmm. What he wants to do is bless me. And I know that that's in the context of all the other things that I am dealing with, wrestling with, giving him, hanging on to, all that is churning, always so like spinning.
Right. What's the biggest headaches of owning a donut business?
Well, we're franchisors. So we found out early on that people wanted to open shops. And that was something we had to figure out. We didn't know how to do that. So once we figured it out, we were able to move into that kind of sort of relationship with others. So people would come to us and say, we want to open a Peace, Love, and Little Donuts. And we would initially try and talk them out of it because it's kind of like marriage. If you can be talked out of it, you should be talked out of it. So the idea is you got to make sure you know what you're getting into. And we knew people really didn't know. So we were trying to give them a full, you know, eyes wide open, look at what it is they were doing. At the same time, we were trying not to give away the store and teach everybody how to do what we do.
Yeah.
So that happened and over again. We figured that out. The hard part is that speed marriage. We used to sign agreements for 20 years. Now it's 10, but you're gonna get connected to somebody for 10 years who you've met, what, 3 times? Mm.
Uh-huh.
And spent, what, 4 hours with? That's brutal, especially because no one tells you that they're neurotic or they're nuts.
Oh, by the way, I have a serious attraction to gerbils and sometimes gets in the way of my business sense. So,
can we do a gerbil donut? Because that would really work for me.
Yeah.
It's hard to even. I mean, the number of things I could write a book about how, you know, things have gone off the rails, but God puts them right back on the rails. That's the hardest part, really, is managing people, because there are people that own my donut shops that don't necessarily have the same goals and passions that I do with regard to like making this the best they can do. They don't wake up and think, how can I be better? They think, I'm good. And that's tough to motivate somebody who's like that. If you've ever had anybody around you who doesn't necessarily agree that the way they are is mediocre, they just think they're good enough.
Yeah.
And they don't want to lay into that. They're not willing to go through the pain of pruning and reconstruction and dealing with whatever I'm not great at. And they just like, I'm good. Mm. And that's the way they were. I had a guy who opened a shop who had more money than all the other store owners combined. I mean, no matter how much money they all had, he had more. And so all he wanted to do was play around. And his store was open for 2 years and he closed it because it wasn't fun anymore. The minute it became work, he was like, ah, yeah. Like,
he closes it and then doesn't make you royalty payments, or he
I didn't want to enforce that. We could do that, but I don't want to. Listen, if somebody wants out, the last thing I want to do is milk them forever. Let's just part ways and move.
Yeah.
Move on. It'd be different if somebody was, you know, selling another version of us out the side door, making a brand of their own, and then defiling us. That would be different. I'd fight.
How old are you right now, Ronnie?
I'll be 65.
65. So do you have a next adventure you have your eyes on, or is your next adventure squeezing more life and fruitfulness out of Peace, Love, and Donuts?
That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, the pandemic put the real concern in me that we were going to have to reinvent ourselves. Huh. We lost 26 stores.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's quite a haircut.
Yeah, it is.
And whether you're talking about paper routes or you're talking about accounts, you lose half of your accounts and things begin to look. In fact, my kids, who at one point we were hoping they would all work for the brand, I had to get rid of them all. Mm. I mean, I killed them all, but I mean, I had to get rid of them. I laid them all off, put them in different directions, and they are, thank the Lord, they're doing well. But nobody works for the brand anymore, just Marcy and I.
Well, we had an amazing time at Man Camp. You brought your sons.
Gabriel and CJ.
Yeah, brought those guys, and they got their old, like father, like sons, and they're not in donut business, but they're in the entrepreneur business. They got a chimney sweeping business and innovating off of that. They would have a fun way to be in here, Dirt. There's stories of going to their first home to service a chimney and watching YouTube
videos, yeah,
YouTube videos in the person's driveway before they walked in. Oh my gosh, that takes some gonads. Impressive.
Well, I mean, you might call it that. You would call it that, right? But some people would go, "Oh, those frauds." You mean they didn't get a master's degree in chimney sweeping before they did it?
No, they're good. No. They got to figure it out.
Yeah, and they're doing well. They're growing, and they've got a great group of guys, and I'm proud of them.
All right, Ronnie, I want to move off donuts here for a little bit. But first, before we move off donuts, I'm going to do a lightning round. I'm going to bring the lightning round from the end of the podcast. If we do a lightning round, it's at the end. Here in the somewhere in the middle. The lightning round is when I ask you something, you have to answer it like quick answer. Are you up for the lightning round?
Come on.
Here you go. Your favorite little donut flavor.
Robert Brulee. It's okay, called the Robert Brulee. It's like a creme brulee. We actually torch it.
Ooh.
You didn't deserve any of those, so I didn't give you one.
All right. I can ask a follow-up question, but you did a good job. You just answer real quick. Good. Best-selling flavor?
Cinnamon roll.
Most colossal flavor failure?
Ghostbusters. One of our managers came up with it. Vanilla frosting, mini marshmallows, drizzled vanilla. It was a winner.
That sounds good. No.
Oh.
Okay. All right. I like the creative idea. All right. We'll keep going here. How many little donuts do you eat in a week?
I'd say depends on who doesn't show up for work. That's normally if I'm making donuts, that's when I eat donuts. I don't eat donuts if I don't make donuts.
Okay.
So I'm not in the shop. But if I'm in the shop and I'm making donuts, buddy,
you're eating donuts.
I'm eating donuts. I might eat two a day.
Two a day?
Yep.
So I just had your quota because I just ate two here. Sheesh. Aggressive move you're making right now.
Stock. I'm investing in the stock market. Mm. I'm trusting God, and I'm saying this is your money. If you want to grow it, grow it.
hardest part about scaling a business?
I would say you have to have a brutal appreciation for the truth. You cannot tell yourself a lie every day and say, oh, this is going to work out. Oh, it's going to be fine. Oh, that's okay. Because most of the time, it's not going to work out. It's not going to be okay. You have to decide ahead of time that you're not going to be allergic to the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth in business is often in the form of a spreadsheet or a cash flow statement.
Last one. The thing about running a donut shop that most people wouldn't understand.
They would not understand that people will get out of their car if the product is good enough. Most people just don't make a product that's good enough to get you to get out of the car. That's why they have drive-thrus. That's why they have a lot of things. But the proof that we're good enough is that somebody will get out of their car in the rain with their kids and come into the store and buy donuts.
So you don't have drive-up windows?
Not a single store.
That's a philosophy, or that's this, you haven't had the stores that could have the...
It's the money. Like, yeah. So when we decide to enter the marketplace and we want to do a store that has a drive-thru, like let's say Long John Silver's goes belly up.
Yeah.
And they had a drive-thru. Perfect, right? Wrong. Because I'm bidding against Starbucks and Dunkin' and Popeyes and Cane's and everybody else whose revenue per store is five times mine.
Right.
I mean, think about the difference between me and Chick-fil-A. They have three drive-thrus. Mm-hmm. I don't even have one.
Yeah.
Mostly because we just don't have the revenues to support it. We can't pay a price. We can't pay $2 million for a piece of a land and do our average unit volumes, which are nothing like some of these other stores. I mean, we're not nothing, but we're not competitive in that way.
Right. Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. But your next adventure, you've spoken for a long time. One of your consistency things that you've always spoken with a passion, regardless of how you were making money, was marriage.
Yep. Yeah.
You've been bending your life towards that for a while. Why?
Well,
I don't mean just your marriage with Marcy. Right. I mean, I think it's the first time I ever called her Marcy. Mark. Not just your marriage with Mark, but your desire to help people who are married.
Well, you and I have been ringside for a lot of mistakes and a lot of blow-ups, right? And when that happens to anybody you know, it's tragic. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody picks sides and it's ugly. And if you have ongoing relationships, sometimes it's difficult because somebody thinks you're picking sides when you're trying desperately not to. But when it happens to somebody who's in the ministry, it's not just tragic. It's tectonic. And I think what it does to the church and what it does to people who go, see, they couldn't even keep it together. So back then I thought, you know, that's one of the toughest things to do is be married in the fishbowl of church leadership. And having tasted very little of it, you know, having worked in the church for the years that I did and also working for John Guest as directing his crusade ministry, I mean, the culture is always interesting, but sometimes that culture just simply wants you to do more, and it doesn't care about what it, whether you're counting the cost or balanced in your approach or taking care of your wife and kids or whatever. I mean, they sometimes they'll give you enough rope to hang yourself.
Yes.
And that happens quite a bit, right? And I'd seen it happen, and it was awful. And I thought, wow, you know, I'd love to do something about that if I could, mostly because I think I have it easy. I mean, you know, nobody has a perfect marriage, but I think there are marriages that take 1,000,000 pounds of force to get into the atmosphere, and then there are marriages that take 1,000 pounds of force. Mine's a relatively easy lift. My wife's not adversarial about much. We agree about a lot of things to begin with. She came to Christ during our dating time, so she's always been with me and supportive. I mean, she said, sell my car. I mean, that was, we were in free fall financially, about to lose our home, and she says, sell my car. I mean, this is a woman that, for whatever reason, God, you know, gave her to me, and the last thing I want to do is mess that up.
Yeah.
So watching that happen, I thought, I don't know how to do that, though. So early on, you and I have been exposed to this phrase, and I think it made a difference to me, caught versus taught. And I think the thing about a healthy marriage is I think there's a lot of aspects of a healthy marriage in context of ministry leadership that's caught and not taught. Mm. That means somebody's got to be around you for a little while. Mm. So over time, what came to be was this idea of taking pastors and their spouses away for a week-long sailing adventure where they might be around my wife and I and see what happens. Trust that God will do what God does, which is bless them. It's not like, you know, I'm going to teach you how to say I love you to your wife, and we don't do that. But I mean, not that I don't say it, but that's not the purpose of it. The purpose of it is that there's this communal fellowship, and during that time, things are transferred that are unknown and unseen. Mm. And that's what I'm trusting in.
Yeah.
And so that was what was born. That's not the next phase, but it's really a parallel path. I mean, it's what we're doing. It's why we put overalls on the business, and we put that money to work in the ministry. That we formed a 501c3 back before the pandemic, and it's about, you know, it's cranking.
One of the things I've always liked about you is you will try new things. We mentioned a number of them, trying new businesses, that sort of thing. Also, you just dropped the sailing thing. You try new things that you just got a captain's license. Very few people ever learn something new, let alone when they're 40 years out of college or whatever you are.
Yeah.
Tell us about your captain's license.
Well, that was fun. We went for a week-long certification cruise. The American Sailing Association has schools all over that are accredited to teach you. And I signed up for one, and Marcy and I went. And it was, you know, it was a chance for you to prove that you know your stuff. Because what I wanted to do with that license was not so much become a maritime, you know, captain, but really to rent very expensive sailboats all over the world, and somebody's going to give you the keys to this $1 million boat. You got to prove to them that you know what you're doing. Mm. And so this is my way of proving to them that I know what I'm doing. I've been tested, I've been certified, and therefore I should be responsible. Now, of course, you know, I'm sure there's people that are much more experienced than I that wrap a boat around something that doesn't move.
Well, we're going to find out how good you are. You're taking me on one of those things here in about a week or less.
Yeah.
Coming up. So anyway, you go to the school.
Go to school. Two other couples were supposed to be on this voyage. Their planes didn't make it.
Oh, it's a voyage. You're actually on the ship the whole time.
The whole time.
Wow. All right.
So you got to show
ship,
me.
Is that the right thing? Yeah. Ship, vessel, boat?
Saint, they're all right.
All right.
They're all correct. And we were living aboard and traveling along these islands in the Southern Caribbean. And I had to prove that I knew how to do this, do that, all the things you got to do to sail. And it was exciting, challenging at times. And the Sunday we left for our adventure, we're sitting at breakfast with the captain who's teaching the week. And the other people didn't make it. Their planes didn't make it. So it was just me, Marcy, and this guy. So, which ended up being really helpful because we had all this time. which I would maybe not have had that not been present. Because he says, what are your goals, Ron? What are your goals? I said, well, I would like to be certified across all the platforms, basically prerequisites, 101, 103, 104, 114, which are all the numbers that are the classes you need, each one having a prerequisite of the one before. He said, who told you that was possible? I didn't expect that question. Huh. I said, well, the school did, because I told them what I wanted to do, and they go, okay. He goes, well, he goes, technically, they didn't lie to you. It's only ever been done twice, ever, that I'm aware of. He said, how much sailing experience do you have? I said, pretty much none. I mean, I'm a boater, which is different than sailing, but I'm—
You got a motor, and you're going up and down a river or something like that. Yeah.
Right, right. And two engines. I mean, I'm pretty good with boats, but not sailing boats. And so he says, well, the other two guys had tremendous sailing experience. They just never got certified. And so by the time they went through the certification, it was just them checking boxes. I mean, they'd been sailing for years, either on their own boats or boats that they controlled. They weren't, I go, listen, I've failed at lots of stuff in my life, man. So this won't be the first time. If I fail, I fail. He goes, okay, it's a good attitude. So we take off and do 6 days aboard the Inordinate. That was the name of the boat.
Inordinate.
The Inordinate. It was old. It had one working piece of navigation equipment. It had a compass.
Wow.
You know, one of those ones that's been around. That's it.
So this was not a pleasure cruise.
No.
I mean, is this like a wooden ship?
No, it was fiberglass.
Is it a catamaran?
It was a cat.
Okay.
Because it was 114 is the catamaran certification. So anyway, that was the experience. And I got all four.
Wow.
I got signed off on.
Dude.
But you would love the man overboard exercise.
Oh, yeah. Tell me.
They take this kind of floating life jacket looking thing that's designed to look like a person, and they throw it overboard unbeknownst to you, and they yell man overboard. So whenever that happens, you have to do the things like, you know, it's kind of like CPR. You like shake and shout and all the things, the steps. You got to do them in order. You got to do them just right. And then you've got to get the boat reoriented to pick that person up, and you have to be traveling at a certain speed, because if you're going too fast, you'll pull their arms off. Mm. And if you're going too slow, you can't get to them because you have to do it under sail. If it was you, if you fell overboard on this next trip, I'm going to drop the sails immediately. I'm going to turn on both engines and I'm going to turn this thing around on a dime and I'm going to be back at you in like minutes, right?
Right.
That's what it would be. But you're not allowed to use your engine. So you have to do it under sail, which means I'm using conditions, winds. I got to turn around. I do a figure eight. I got to turn around.
Wow.
I've got to find this bobbing piece of flotsam in the water. And then I have to depower the sails, which means dropping the sails at the exact right time so that I run out of gas, basically, movement from the wind right when I get to you. Otherwise, I run you over or otherwise I don't get to you. So I failed. I don't know how many times I failed that exercise before I got it right.
Oh, they give you a number of different shots at it.
Again.
Yeah.
I am Elmer J. Fudd. I want to mention that a yacht. Again. So, I mean, I'd over and over and over again until I got it right. I was probably 7 or 8 times.
Wow.
Yep. And each time the conditions would change a little bit. It wouldn't be like it was exactly the way it was 10 minutes ago. It's different.
Right.
Different wind, different waves.
Well, if you had those other couples there, you probably wouldn't have had time to do that 7 times.
Bingo. Exactly. So I just thought, Lord, okay, well, at least I'm not doing this up against all odds.
So when we head out Saturday, is there always going to be land in sight or not?
Yeah.
Yeah, there will be. Okay.
But especially the strength. So the interesting thing about the Caribbean, from the Bahamas to Trinidad and Tobago, which is a string of what we call the Caribbean, there's only one section, we'll call it a reach. That's what you would call it if you were a sailor. You'd say there's only one reach in all of the Caribbean islands that you can't see land. Mm. Only one. And it's only 100 miles. So it's a 10-hour sail, 10, 15, depending on how slow the wind is. But that's not crazy. And then with GPS, I mean, boats sail themselves. Right. We're not on the Inordinate. We're on like a really high-tech boat that has autopilot. It's a floating Tesla is what it is.
Have you ever seen the movie Dead Calm?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
This is not the time to bring that up. When's this coming out? Don't drop this before our trip.
I'm going to tell everybody at our dinner tonight, go see Dead Calm.
I should bring it as a thing we could watch on Blu-ray disc.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be great. I'm trying to think who would freak out on our crew.
I don't know April well enough to say.
Man wouldn't freak out. Maybe May. She might. 5'12". 5'12" could he very – he's got a little hidden fear monger inside
of
him.
Well, he said that he's out of his element on the water is what
right,
he said.
Right,
so
right.
It's not his thing. So it's going to be interesting. You have to, like, stand by the door, not let anybody out.
Oh, we should do that, and then I can send him memes from Dead Calm for every day before we get there. Nothing says I love you more than inferred fear.
Well, let's I think, you know, the good news is the stretch of islands that we're going to be in is probably the most predictably wonderful wind and waves you're ever going to run into, yeah, especially the time of year we're there. I mean, it's 10 to 15 knot winds every day, sunshine. And the purpose of Peace, Love, and Little Donuts was, of course, to fund this.
Yeah.
That was the idea, is that we might find a way to take pastors away for a week, let them know we love them. We want their marriages not just to make it, but we want them to flourish. And we want them to flourish in such a way that other couples, which desperately need to see this, believe that marriage is a good bet. Because that's the thing right now is off the skids. I mean, the number of people that are deciding to get married is in an absolute free fall, statistically.
Yeah.
And therefore, so is the birth rate.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Younger people are just not, yeah, they're just not getting married. I was just in a meeting here in my day job, Crossroads, last week, where we were talking about reformatting, possibility of reformatting one of our chapels, taking the pews out. And of course, I said, hey, you know, we don't... This is like the only room in a building of ours that has the traditional vibe, traditional feel. It's great for marrying and burying people. You know, it's got that chapel feel and the pews contribute to that.
It's comforting sometimes.
It is very comforting. Even if you're not a traditional person like myself, you walk in and you're like, oh, okay, okay. And the piece of data was heartbreaking was, well, we're not really having anybody get married. So we don't need it as a chapel. Ouch. Ouch.
Well, and I think part of that is because the marriages that are high profile, yours, mine, because of the fact that I have this business that makes my marriage high profile, we tend to cover. We try and live private lives. And we, you know, the world does not reward us for being transparent. Mm-hmm. It attacks you. Mm-hmm. Whatever it doesn't like. I think your shirt's disgusting. I don't like your haircut. Whatever it is, there's somebody's a critic. And everybody is given a microphone to announce what they think about you, your life, your work, your words, your marriage, whatever. They've got a microphone and they shout out about it because I think it in some way makes them feel important when maybe they don't feel important normally.
Right.
So I thought, you know, what I want to do is I want to put a support structure under these pastors and let them know this is Switzerland. You can come here and you don't have to worry about anybody putting a search committee together to replace you no matter what you're dealing with. Let's just deal with it. Let's patch you up. Let's find a way to take the bushel off of your light. Your marriage light needs to be set on a hill because no one sees it. And that is hard.
Yeah.
That's an uphill move. That'd be an uphill move even if we weren't in this toxic culture, but it's uphill and dangerous. And so I think that, so this is the beginning of what I hope is kind of God's movement towards restoring ministries who are married couples into a position of feeling more comfortable sharing married life.
Yeah.
You know, when you say doing life, I think you're the first person I ever heard say that. You asked me years ago, who are you doing? I think we were catching up over something. Yeah. You said, who are you doing life with? And I thought, that is an interesting way mm-hmm. to think about it. I'd never thought of that. And this is 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I'm mostly doing life with people who are safe to me. Still to this day. I don't rarely bring people in who I sense are dangerous in any way, socially, emotionally, you know, physically.
Yeah,
I don't do that because I've got a family to take care of and a business that I'm going to try and, you know, stay intact.
Yeah.
But Christ wants me to go into these places that I'm not safe. And he certainly wants me to take my marriage and put it on a hill and let people see that come hell or high water, I'm leaving with her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that makes her feel good because she sees that I'm not just saying this to her. I'm saying this to the world. I shout this with everything that I do and the things that I attempt. I am saying I'm for her for keeps.
What's something that you do in your marriage that someone who is struggling might not do in their marriage?
I think speak forgiveness. That right there, buddy. If some, and people have said to me, what's the secret? When they find they've been married for more than 40 years, they go, what's the secret? I go, the secret is speaking forgiveness. And they go, what are you talking about? I go, well, when you are in the place where somebody says, that's my fault. I hurt you. I did something I shouldn't have done, or I didn't do something I should have done. Will you forgive me? And most of the time we go, ah, of course. We don't ever say it. And speaking forgiveness is an emotional way of getting yourself off the hook that you're on. And it allows you to then believe that God can restore this. But if you find out that you're just keep doing the same stupid thing you've been doing all along and they never said, I forgive you, it's because they're harboring resentment, right? And it's building up.
Yeah.
And that is that's a marriage killer. It's everything killer. It kills every friendship. It kills every relationship. If you can't clear the deck with forgiveness, and it's never, I think, complete until it's spoken.
Yeah.
That's why I like it. I like it. I like to say, "I please forgive me," and I wait for answer.
There was the researcher, his last name was Gottman. I think it's John Gottman. I think, and it might have been Purdue, some university. And his studies, he said that he could overhear a couple in a restaurant, and he would tell within 5 minutes whether or not they're going to make it or not. And what he looked for was contempt and disdain in their tone of voice. There's any bit
rolling the eyes. That's what Jordan right. Peterson says. You roll the eyes, it's disdain. It's absolute contempt.
There you go.
It's a sign of it. So I think you're right. I mean, once that creeps in, if you can't grab that by the root and tear it out, then even if you break it off, it still grows back. You know, even if you break that root off, that weed off right at the surface, it's just going to keep growing. And you're just going to have another problem. And eventually somebody goes, I'm tired of it, right? That's what they go. I'm tired.
Speaking forgiveness, that's one. What else might you do in your marriage that somebody who's struggling is not doing?
I think the act of dating, continuing to date my wife, as weird as that might sound to people, because men typically we're hunters, right? So we want to go stalk our prey, and then we want to bag our prey, and then we want to mount our prey.
Mount our prey.
We want to mount our prey. And then once the prey's on the wall, then now I can put my feet up, take my stinky shoes off. I can do whatever I want to do, and I'm good. I don't have to go through, quote unquote, the work, the hard work, the pretense, or whatever they might say that is.
Right.
But really what it is continuing to communicate that I would do this all over again if today were the day.
Yeah. Right.
And that's hard to fathom the value of that to a spouse, right? I don't know. I mean, certainly my wife gets to say, yes, I want to do that. You want to go out? Yeah, I'd love to. You know, her response tells me everything, especially depending on how long it's been since I said, hey, we haven't been out in a while. I want to go outside. Why don't we go out? Let's have a date.
Yeah.
And she's always been very sort of communicative when it comes to how she's excited about that idea.
You mentioned with pastors, you only want to help. You feel only a call to help pastors in their marriages, or is that going to trickle to everybody at some point?
I don't think it's going to go to everybody, but I may be wrong. I mean, God might show me something else, but I think the key being is there's only so many people and so much time.
Yeah.
And so the speed of the coach is the speed of the team. If you had a ministerial staff that had elevated their marriages to a level where we understood that this is a virus we want other people to catch.
Right.
The question is, how exposed are people to our marriages? Because when your kid goes to a daycare, you know your kid's coming back with the sniffles, right? Yeah. I mean, it's only a matter of time. Why? Because they were exposed. So if loving your spouse is a virus, who is going to catch that?
Right.
Who's going to get exposed enough? Who's going to be close enough? Who's going to be in the blast radius of your love affair?
Yeah.
And they're going to catch that. Because listen, when I say my wife's name, it's different than when you say it.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds different. It is different. It speaks to the 1,000 things I've done, the 10,000 things I've done that back up how I feel about her. And so that is something that I want to – other people hear that. I don't know whether they have conversation. We've had people come to us long before we even started this. They said, your marriage has always been to us like a standard. And for a long time, my wife and I would shake our head and go, huh, like we never intended that.
Yeah.
But people would say that. And so we started to take stock in the fact that maybe God's doing something here. Maybe we have to be, it's kind of like you don't realize it, but the water you're drinking, it comes up out of the backyard, is the fountain of youth. You're not aging and everybody else is. Hmm. Huh. So I should share this water that's coming up out of the ground? Hmm. So I have this fountain of what I think is a less efforted love affair that's predicated on a lot of things that I think maybe we got right because of the context of us getting together. You know, Marcy came out of a non-Christian home. They didn't come to our wedding. That's how bad that was.
Yeah.
And I came out of a non-Christian family. And so we just had each other. There was no marital sort of, there was no gravitational force to any family members at all beyond the two of us. And so there was no running home to mama. There was none of that.
Right.
There was roll up your sleeves, figure it out, admit when you're wrong, which is not the same as saying you're sorry. Saying you're sorry is, please shut up about it.
Yeah, I'm sorry I made you feel that way. Or I'm sorry you feel that way, even worse.
Your feelings are your problem.
Yeah.
You know, how you respond to the truth is your problem. All the things people say in order to get themselves off the hook. I think the most important thing is, at the end of it, are you more likely to be better as a person because you admitted that what you did was a really dumb thing, or maybe not really dumb, but just a little bit dumb. But at the end of the day, if you're not becoming a bright, shiny version of yourself, then I don't know who you're worshiping.
Yeah, the ministry in marriage, it's a blessing and a curse. It's a curse in that there are eyeballs that are on you that sometimes forces you to fulfill a role that you really don't feel like fulfilling. When things are hurting, you can't escape it. You know, when things are hurting in your marriage, you work in corporate America, well, you can basically sever it. You can sever it. It doesn't impact as much. But man, when you're in ministry and your marriage isn't right, and it hangs on you when you're given, you can't give a talk on marriage, your marriage isn't well. You can't give a talk on, you know, being a faithful bride of Christ or being a faithful groom if you and your spouse aren't faithful. It can be an ominous weight that you feel like you need to sometimes escape from and sometimes do unhealthy things. And therefore, it's also a blessing because you go, man, stakes are high here. We cannot afford for this to go wrong, and we have to keep on our game and work this out. Because if we don't work this out, there are ramifications on a lot of people, because we're a model for people, like it or not, we're a model for people. And if we've modeled that you can't make it and that marriage is too hard and not worth it, that's a horrible thing to the institution.
Yeah, I think it's hard regardless, but I think pastors have it even harder because of those sort of endemic pieces of it that make it very, very, everything's wired to blow. You really can't, you don't have anybody you can really talk to. If you do, then everybody loses their mind. And then the whole gossip thing is just goes wild, you know. And that right there, it's tough to, as you know, the last thing I would ever tell a man to do is live in secret shame long term. That would be the most toxic advice you could ever give a man. And so if you really want to be a husband that can lead, and leading is listening and then acting. And if you can't figure that out because you are living in the shame of bad decisions, or you've been harmed. I mean, there are men out there that you and I have been to man camp, and there's no end to the number of wounds that men have suffered.
Right.
And those wounds make it very tough to love anybody. I mean, we try and say, hey, can you just see your heavenly father in a different light than your earthly father? Most guys can't. They can't figure that out. Like, my earthly father was a jagoff. I can't possibly, like, my heavenly father, if he's anything like my earthly father, I'm not interested.
Do you know what that is, Dirt? A jagoff?
I think I can fill in the blank. Yeah.
That's basically
Pittsburghese.
Pittsburghese for jerk.
Yep.
And I assume jagoff is an iteration of exactly what you think it is. Jerk off,
I
guess.
Yeah. Jerk. Yeah. You're a jerk.
Jagoff.
You jagoff. But, yeah, if that's the way you see your heavenly father, then you're likely not to be able to follow, earthly father. You're not going to follow your heavenly father very far. And if you are, you're not going to be vulnerable. You're not going to say, hey, I need rewired. I got a problem here. I can't tame this problem that I have. It keeps biting me.
Right.
And it keeps harming my relationship, my sacred relationship. You know, the thing about your marriage and my marriage is that even though we don't want to get into the sort of the Catholic idea of things, but the sacramental nature of marriage is such that it has an innate and unique ability to glorify God. Very much like they say there's no atheists in foxholes or delivery rooms. It's because once you see that, once you see what's going on, you have very short distance to reach your Heavenly Father. Mm-hmm. It's right there because it has to be. You don't have any choices. So the idea that our marriages are sacramental in a sense means they're under attack. I mean, mm-hmm. if anybody had a wonderful, effervescent relationship that had challenges that people knew this isn't perfect, but they know these guys roll up their sleeves and they figure it out, that would be an absolute beacon to people. Because you'd be like, well, how did that work? How's that possible? Because everybody else is simply sort of wallowing in failure after failure after failure, mistake after mistake, because they just don't know how to put it together. So that's why I think it's super important, not just for everybody who's married, to try and find out a way to refresh your marriage and renew it, but also to be in the context of some leadership couples who are sort of speaking light and life into your marriage.
So, Ron, if someone wants to contact you and interact with you about anything or see your business, go ahead, give an advertisement for yourself.
Oh, great. Ron at peacelovinglittledonuts.com. So they can go to our website and see the whole, sort of kit and caboodle. And then they can reach out to me, Ron at peacelovinglittledonuts.com. And the and is not the ampersand, it's the A-N-D.
It's good, man. We talked everything from donuts to business to marriage. It's a good day for me. Good day for me talking about good stuff and being with a good dude and a good friend. So I don't know what you heard here that you might want to do. This is what we do here. We spur one another on towards action. Do something with what you did here. Maybe if you're married, you want to forgive your spouse. Stop being contentious towards them. Maybe you want to try something new. Maybe you want to branch out and gain some weight and have a little donut. It's whatever it is. Hope you got something here. Thanks for coming with us. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks of a Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to Dirt, that's Dirt, at briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.